We've been digital friends and somewhat comrades for a couple of years now. And I've always been a long admirer of Chris Troutner and his developer work, his advocacy. You see him on Telegram. He's got his fingers kind of in everything. He can be your uber technical guru guide that solves all your problems. He can be a philosophical voice of reason. He's also an extremely compassionate guy. There's just so many great things to say about Chris Troutner, and you're going to find out why in our conversation today. But before I get too much further into that, Chris Troutner, hey, Trout, thanks so much, man, for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, man. Yeah, you are the king of intros. I got to give you that.
Well, it's all true. I believe every word of it, and I've watched from afar. I've read. I remember editing your stuff on Avalanche way back, and you're a thought leader, and you're a guy that we lean on. And I see you everywhere, and for whatever reason, just I don't know. I kind of take you for granted. You're sort of part of the Bitcoin furniture, and I just sort of assume that you're there. And I was like, you know what? We haven't really spoken, Now, I would say arguably the most interesting guy in crypto is Andreas Brecken, if you know anything about him.
And his huge style. Fan.
Yeah, that guy is just super fascinating. So I'd say he's up there. I'd say you're also in the top two or three. You've got an interesting story, an interesting lifestyle. So let's maybe start there. You take the digital nomad thing kind of to the extreme, right? Can you kind of tell people sort of how you live?
Yeah, you know, the digital nomadism thing, I really respect people who do that. And I haven't. Like, I went through a phase, and for people, so before we started recording, we talked about a podcast I did a couple years ago with Matt Aaron, and he really went into sort of my lifestyle of how I lived on a boat for about 7 years before
Just to interrupt you, Matt Aaron is my nemesis, and that podcast is such an incredible episode. I will link to it in the, I was just teasing him, I think this morning, telling him how wonderful it was. And there's no way I was going to beat that podcast. So we'll link to it in the show notes here, so you guys can kind of see where Chris was a little over a year ago. But I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah, that was a great episode. But anyway, you said
we'll see. This podcast is young, so let's see if we can outdo it. But yeah, so I lived on a boat for about 7 years, and then I bought this piece of property on an island here in Washington State in the San Juan Archipelago. And I've just slowly been working on that for the last couple of years. Really, my whole life for the last 2 years has just been either Bitcoin Cash or working on my property. And those are really like, I'm kind of single-minded and very focused. And I don't have a lot of distractions.
Yeah, and you spend at least part of your time, or you had, on a boat, right?
Yeah, I still do. I actually was pretty excited to bring it over here and anchor it up. I need to give it a little love. But before I got back into the crypto space, so to go way back, I was actually like very early with Bitcoin. I was so early that I mined 50 Bitcoin with my home computer back in 2009. But then I left the space.
Wow.
Right around like 2014, when the very first drama around the scaling debate, you know, started to pop its head up, and things started getting nasty. I was kind of more focused on my career. I always respected the technology of Bitcoin and its potential, but I also always thought it was a long shot that it would survive this long. So that's, and it was when Gabriel Cardona, when he made his first YouTube video on the Bitcoin.com channel and started talking about this JavaScript library that he built that can interact with the Bitcoin blockchain, I like literally jumped out of my chair and I was like, yes, this is what I've been waiting for. And so I just dove straight back down into the rabbit hole and picked up where I left off. And you know, a big part of my job when Gabriel hired me was developer advocacy. So that's, I'm stoked to hear you refer to me as part of the Bitcoin furniture, because that's exactly what I want to be. I want to be just a big part of my job is just talking to technical people, talking to non-technical people, trying to get them to talk to one another, trying to be mindful of the audience that I'm talking to, because I love talking shop. I mean, I just love it. I love talking shop. But
you're a natural teacher, and there's some people who, so if, and I'm going to, I don't know why I'm bringing up this reference, but I'm sometimes in love of my own pseudo profundity here. But if you're into baseball at all, there were two shortstops in the 80s, Ozzie Smith and Gary Templeton. And Ozzie Smith was considered the wizard. So he would do backflips and he would get to balls that no one thought he could get to defensively. And he was just an amazing acrobat. Gary Templeton was a bit of a, they called him the smooth operator. And he was very, you know, he made things look so, while Ozzie Smith made everything look hard as the wizard, Gary Templeton made everything look easy. And I always admired Gary Templeton a little, even though he was, you know, less sexier in terms of the highlight reel, you would see him sort of lay out, get to the same balls, and actually more than Ozzie Smith over time, and do more, but just make it look easier. You're sort of the Gary Templeton, if I could extend the metaphor of developers, in that you make these super complex issues seem approachable, palatable, easier to understand. And whenever I hear you talk, whether it's on someone else's podcast, you make a bunch of YouTube clips teaching different things in Telegram chat rooms, I always feel smarter walking away. So you're definitely that guy. But I think maybe a lasting contribution that you and Gabriel had, I was just looking at it 2 days ago, is developer.bitcoin.com. You guys more or less built that, right?
Yeah, I mean, the lion's share of the work went to Gabriel, and then I basically took the raw magic, if you will, and just focused on polishing it. You know, Gabriel really has that. So he's a visionary. I mean, he is a visionary. He sees things that people don't see. He sees the next step. He's just like Steve Jobs, where like he understands what people want before they do. And so I just, you know, tried my best to recognize that trait and to just polish, you know, his insights.
Yeah. You guys were a really, really, really good team. Shout out to Gabriel Cardona. We've got some wonderful podcasts with him over the years as well. So you're living basically on an island. You're building a cabin. You're one of these self-sustainable guys. I guess a natural question before we get into the reason that I have you on, which has to do with privacy and Bitcoin Cash, and kind of a discovery you've made through reverse engineering. How have you sort of found, with coronavirus and the breakout and the pandemic, as we spoke before the show, I'm in Southern California, and so we're extremely pampered here. So anytime there's even the mildest inconvenience, we flip out and couch faint and grab our pearls. I'm assuming the Pacific Northwest has slightly more robust population, and you being a self-sufficient dude are probably faring, you know, a little bit better. But how have you found it thus far?
Yeah, well, let me start by just pointing out, like, this. I'm going to I think this concept of community is going to keep coming back. It's going to like foreshadow everything we're going to have in this conversation. So I wanted to point people to this, my old blog, sanjuansufficiency.com, and sufficiency is a really hard word to spell, but I haven't touched that blog in years. But in that blog, I talk about, that was like, I documented my journey into living on a boat and becoming more self-sufficient, and sort of my exploration of what community is and why it's valuable, and how to like consciously participate in it. And it's those lessons that I brought with me to the Bitcoin Cash space when Gabriel hired me. And it gets right back to the, about the COVID response. I love living on this little island because the community is, I mean, we just immediately started rallying around one another. Like, okay, like if, you know, we're thinking about if things even get worse than this, you know, what would we do? And even just like in this sort of what I would call this little mild, in terms of how bad things could get, but it's just been great to have a little posse of other islanders that I hang out with, and we're all quick to help. We're all low, you know, short, fun. No one's ever, what out here in the islands, you're either a millionaire or a pauper. There's really no in between. And so we all help one another. It's a largely like non-financial type of relationship for most of us, and that it's that sense of community that I love. But yeah, being out here is, I have been, the weirdest thing for me is how unweird it is, because I'm so focused on just the things that I'm doing, and I'm so self-sufficient that I went to the mainland for the first time in like 3 months, just like last week, and just got some more supplies, and it looks like people's worlds have been turned on their heads. But this is exactly the kind of scenario. I mean, I am a prepper. I wear that badge proudly, and so I'm in my element right now. I'm just like, yep, this is what I've been preparing for.
Yeah. And so you said that you were somewhat impressed by the mainland and how they've kind of adapted there in Washington State, right?
Yeah. So my last supply run was in February. I saw, you know, this sort of pandemic coming from quite a ways away. I'm kind of sensitive to those things. And like the Ebola outbreak back in 2014, that really scared the crap out of me. I was ready to set sail for a few months. And then it, you know, they got it under control. And so what I didn't want was to be on the mainland when everyone else was trying to figure out the new normal. And so going back last week, it was nice. Everybody's wearing masks. There's like lines on the sidewalk to keep everybody 6 feet apart. Seems like, you know, the system, I am amazed at how quickly the American, just in general, businesses and stuff have adapted to this new normal. I did not expect that. I thought it was just going to be like mayhem and pandemonium, and no one's going to want to shift their mentality at all to deal with the new reality. I'm really impressed with what's the word? Just the resilience of people around this. I'm also, you know, glad that I was able to do a quick run and get back here.
Yeah, for sure. I was thinking as you were talking that, you know, things are moving so fast. Washington State, if people don't know, in the United States, as opposed to the District of Columbia, we're talking now the Pacific Northwest, it was more or less the epicenter at one point of the virus outbreak in the U.S. And there's in the unfolding narrative of the chronology of how this sort of makes its way across, it kind of begins there, and there's all sorts of drama with a physician, a university researcher, who just kind of bucks regulators and goes out, and she just goes, "No, I'm gonna. This is something. There's some there. You know, there's some there. There's some something we need to do." And she just starts making her way and making these discoveries. So you were definitely right, sort of right at ground zero in the United States. So I guess that's heartening to hear. That's really heartening to hear.
Yeah. Seattle was the hot spot for a long time, and then New York overtook us just because of their population density. I mean, the virus just spread like wildfire in that scenario. Whereas the Pacific Northwest, I mean, Seattle's a modern city, but it had the virus has had a hard time like getting out to the outskirts. But yeah, the mainland where I come in from is there. I mean, it's made national news with some of the people getting sick. So that's, I think, another reason why people are taking it so seriously up here. Because I've had a significant, one of the things I think makes me very different than the average person dealing with this is because of my prepper mentality. I saw this coming from a long ways away. I was totally prepared. There was no fear or reaction, to it. I've managed to be proactive every step of the way. And so to bring this conversation back around to like the Earn It Act, that's one of the things that I see, like there's just so much stuff happening behind the scenes now because everyone's distracted by COVID-19. And, you know, like the saying goes, politicians never let a good emergency go to waste.
That's right.
And so the Earn It Act's been around for a while, and I didn't think it had a chance in hell. But because everyone's distracted, it's much more dangerous now. And
this is a piece of legislation that is emanating out of the United States Senate. And we have some politicians in the United States, not exactly known for their, their love of privacy, for the average citizen. And chief among them would be Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. He and a group of senators, bipartisan senator here from my state in California, Dianne Feinstein, and a group of others, some fairly big heavy hitters, have come forward with a piece of legislation that really takes on end-to-end encryption. Do you want to kind of what alarmed you about it when you first heard about it, and why, before we get into specifics of how you address it?
Yeah, I mean, I think a big part of the sort of the historical setup for all of this is, Facebook did Libra and the politicians weren't too crazy about that idea. And then he immediately, or at the same time, I don't know if it had anything to do with it, but he started at the big like Facebook developer, or I think it was developer conference. He was like, we need to make Facebook more private. And he had he really was beating that drum. Like, we got to have better privacy. And so I think the Earn It Act is largely like a response to both like the we hate Facebook because of the Libra thing and, privacy is bad, from a politician standpoint. So I think it's largely a reaction. And it's definitely targeted at the larger social media companies, not necessarily Bitcoin or anything like that. But that's not to say that those wouldn't have repercussions with it.
Yeah, yeah. And so they're basically advocating, and it's working its way through Congress now. But it's basically advocating a national council or panel of about 17 people, give or take, who would more or less issue licenses for tech companies to enable, or however the language would eventually be sussed out, for them to be able to utilize tools like end-to-end encryption in messaging services or on their platforms, and they would require they would have to pass a battery of filters and tests, according to this counselor panel, essentially giving law enforcement and others a kind of a back door. The pretext, of course, is child exploitation, as it normally is. And there's certainly, some very sober and rational worries there. But why would something like that, so why not just sort of give in to what seems like a kind of a reasonable request of lawmakers and law enforcement to just go, well, let's go slow with end-to-end encryption? Like, why are privacy hawks looking at this and going, no, 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 no.
Yeah, this is like, you know, they say that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. You know, it's a Mark Twain quote. And that's largely what's happening here is, I mean, the battle has been raging in Washington, D.C. for the better part of a decade about this encryption thing. And the thing that the politicians are fighting, they think they're fighting the tech companies, but what they're actually fighting is mathematics. And it's just, I mean, there's the obvious, like the canned response is, well, you can't add a backdoor for just the good guys because that's a subjective interpretation. And the bad guys, you know, the NSA can't even keep their stuff secret. So it's just the whole setup to be a backdoor just for the government is like a red herring. But also that just on another level, when I say they're fighting math, it's this idea that they can somehow control math or bring math to heel to their political agenda. And if you go back in history, like encryption was originally like the whole concept of encryption, like the implementation of encryption in a computer was treated as a munition, and it was illegal to export an encryption algorithm outside of the USA. And so some of these early cypherpunk activists, they started printing the one or two lines of code necessary to do encryption on t-shirts and wearing them around to just show that like this isn't something that you can control. It's any more than a sentence in an email somewhere. And so it's the same thing. If there was anything that I was trying to bring to light with the work I did with this BCH encrypt program, it's just that this end-to-end encryption capability is baked into Bitcoin, and it has been for the last 11 years since Bitcoin's been around. So to try and stop it now is, you know, you're getting pretty you're pretty late to the party.
And this takes us or takes you and our conversation to a mutual friend in Vin Armani, who full circle here has just been on fire with regard to coronavirus and tweeting about it all the time. And mm-hmm. He is definitely a thought leader. And, you know, I haven't heard him talk too much about the attacks on E2EE, but I know it's a concern of his, but he seemingly released a library that triggered something in you. Can you go into that a little bit and then how you connect that back to the Earn It Act?
Yeah, so to frame this, so it makes a little more sense, you mentioned the YouTube videos that I put out, and I'm constantly getting helpful advice on how to make my YouTube videos, and I appreciate it, but I think one of the things that a lot of people miss is I'm never trying to, like, be like, hey, everybody, I made this thing, and here it is, and isn't it perfect? That's never my whole focus, like, since I got back into the Bitcoin space, working for Bitcoin.com, was being a developer advocate. And a big part of that is finding, you know, developers are cats. I always tell people this, like, developers are cats. You can't herd them like sheep. How do you herd cats? Well, the way you herd cats is you put treats and you invite them to come where you want them to go. And that's how you herd cats. And Gabriel largely taught me that. And so a big part of what I do, or what I try to do to move the space forward, is to understand these developers and their passions and their focuses and also their limitations. And so what I try to do with these YouTube videos is usually not to like solve a problem, but to simply take the technology that one developer like kind of got, you know, move the ball forward a little bit, and maybe another developer working on a totally different problem, move the ball forward that, and just show how they're related and how like this, and get the code out there and get other developers interested in just helping me connect the dots rather than me trying to do it all myself. And so in the case of Vin, he released he's really been digging in the last year into the elliptic curve cryptography that is behind the Bitcoin protocol and makes the Bitcoin protocol work. And so he took basically that the core encryption that happens in Bitcoin, and he took it and he figured out how to like apply it to actually like encrypting, you know, stuff like the same way an email would be encrypted. And he focused more on the Bitcoin file protocol, which was developed by James Cramer. But that protocol hasn't really gotten a lot of traction. I was actually just talking to James about it yesterday, and he hasn't touched that code in over a year. And it's an interesting idea. It's just one of the things I think we've learned is that the blockchain's not a good place to store generic data because it's so expensive and inefficient. So I just took, I pulled out the encryption that Ben had worked on and put together and figured out. And I combined that with, instead of using the Bitcoin file protocol, I combined it with the memo.cache and member.cache. So most people aren't familiar with those sites. Memo.cache is like Twitter. It's the same like kind of idea, except it's on the blockchain, so it can't be censored. And it's also permanent. Like, you know, people get upset about how Twitter, you can't edit your tweets. Well, you really can't do that when it's written to the blockchain. And then right. member.cache just extended that idea so that you could have, instead of a single tweet, you could do a series of posts and then combine them all into one large post. And so member.cache is like Reddit, and it's built off the same ideas of memo.cache, just taken one step further. And so I'm a big fan of the protocol because it's so simple. It's this on-chain protocol for sending messages. So I just applied Vin's encryption to those ideas. I just connected those two dots.
And, you know, immediately I didn't at all see a connection to the Earn It Act and how that might be a foil ultimately in anyone's attempt to create, you know, permissioned or any kind of permanent permissioned messaging system. But do you think you stumbled onto that conclusion, or was this something you were heading into kind of directly, or did you find it later?
Well, I mean, I'm a crypto anarchist and I'm a cypherpunk. And so every time one of these bills come through Congress that's trying to stomp on either our right to free speech or our right to privacy or both, you know, I'm mindful of them. And thankfully in the past, there's been many bills and they've all been defeated. And I just expected the same thing with the Earn It Act. But then when the COVID thing happened, I thought, wow, this is really, I mean, distracting and for good reasons. And so it's a good opportunity for them to slip this Earn It Act, you know, behind the scenes. And so it sort of, seeing those two things happen at the same time really made me more aware of it. And so that's why I kind of just gave a tip of the hat to it when I was just sharing, you know, what I had built.
And you make some pretty bold statements when you release it. I saw it on our BTC and maybe in a Telegram chat room, and you were saying, look, the implications of this are that, you know, no one can touch end-to-end encryption if we do it in this manner. They won't be able to, I mean, they can legislate against anything, but it will ultimately have no teeth, right?
Yeah, I mean, to put this into perspective, it's like let's say they passed some legislation that said that Bitcoin can no longer use pseudo-anonymous addresses. You know, like, what would that do? Nothing. Like, they're just too late to the party. So in a similar way with the end-to-end encryption, they're just too late to the party.
And so how does your reverse engineering Vin's library idea and the elliptical curve encryption come together? like, where do you see it ultimately heading? Do you think people will... or application devs will put it into wallets, or does it necessarily, I guess, depend on more adoption?
Yeah, so really what I was trying to do was inspire the developers behind memo.cache and member.cache to pick it up from what I did. And they have. I've been in communication with FreeTrade, who runs member.cache, and he's in the process of integrating my code into that platform. And nice. And I want to point out that other developers on Reddit have pointed out that there is a risk here by putting messages on chain, even if they're encrypted. Like, that might be fine for today, but down the road, someone might figure out how to decrypt them. And so this isn't necessarily like the best way to go about it. But it is a way to go about it, and it's using the tools that are just lying around us right now. And so there's value in that. So it's more inspirational than like the final, you know, thing that like to end all things. This is just one step down the road. I think it makes Bitcoin Cash more, just like memo.cash and member.cash, I feel are making Bitcoin Cash more useful, giving them utilitarian value. I think this is just one more, you know, feather in that cap of, it's like, yeah, here is a little bit more utilitarian value. If you are stuck behind the Great Firewall of China and you want to get a message to someone somewhere else, which is a common problem, because there is a huge, I mean, your listeners might not be aware of this, but I know you are, that there's a huge communication gap between the West and the East. With Bitcoin Cash, particularly with the developer community, and trying to, I've tried very hard to sort of cross that barrier, and it's very difficult. And this would be one way where, and this is what I, this is the cypherpunk in me that just loves, you know, this idea of the blockchain, because there's two important aspects to it. One is the encryption, and that's pretty straightforward. Anybody who's ever encrypted an email, that's the exact same process. The other thing that's not quite so obvious is the content delivery. So if you can encrypt a message, it doesn't necessarily mean you can get it to the person you're trying to send it to. That's where the Great Firewall of China would say stop it. But if you can write the message to the blockchain, then any full node that has a copy of the blockchain, which is how they work, will have that content. And so it's much more difficult to stop than, say, like stopping an email or stopping a web page or stopping a tweet. Those are fairly easy to stop. But the governments have not figured out how to stop a piece of content from being written to the blockchain.
Fascinating implications there. And I wonder, because we share so much with BTC, is there any advantage to doing, like, why Bitcoin Cash? Why look to it and its chain and so on, and the applications that are being or that have been built on it as a delivery system here? Why not another blockchain?
That's a really good question, and I'm sure a lot of people are asking that question, and there's really good reason. So there's a reason why this wouldn't work on BTC, and there's a reason why this wouldn't work on BSV. The reason it wouldn't work on BTC is because the op return is much smaller, and so one of the big problems I had to solve was, how do I break up a message that won't fit in one transaction and send it in multiple transactions and then reassemble it on the other side? And member.cash had already solved that problem, the reassembly problem. So all I had to figure out was the first half of, how do I break it up in a way that member.cash can put it back together? And so that problem would be even harder on BTC, because the op return size is smaller, and the transaction fee, it would be much more expensive because of the transaction fees. And it was just like, it's not a good cultural fit. Writing stuff to the op return is sort of taboo in the BTC culture.
Right.
And then it wouldn't work very well in BSV, because their blocks are so big. Now, the advantage of using BSV is that it could all fit in a single transaction, because their op return is essentially unlimited. But their blocks are so big that they are actually fairly easy to censor. I'm a fan. I'm personally a big fan of Bitcoin Cash, because I feel like we're in the Goldilocks zone of the op return, which is, so for people who are unfamiliar with the op return, it's a way to include a text, just arbitrary metadata or text, in with a transaction. And so BTC made this decision to make it small. BSV made this decision to make it big. And I think BCH is just right. We found, because BCH, the primary use case for BCH is cash. It's digital cash for the world, and anything else that it does is not as important as that. But by choosing the size that the community chose for the op return, It's just right. We can send just enough data, and if it's not enough, we can sort of chunk it out into multiple transactions and make it work that way. And I really feel like from a technological and engineering perspective, BCH has found that Goldilocks zone.
My mind is racing here with the implications, and hopefully it's going to spark, as you say, leaving devs and visionaries little treats and herding these cats towards more permissionless content generation and messaging and all that good stuff. I think there's a definite need for it, and as you say, there's kind of a perfect storm brewing right now. Going forward, how do we find all things Trout? Chris Troutner, keep up with what he's doing. I know you've since moved on from .com, and you're on to other projects now. How can we find you and follow you?
Yeah, I'm spending the majority of my time these days on a website called fullstack.cash. So instead of .com, it's .cash, which is popular with the Bitcoin Cash space. And I'm really, it's just an extension of the work I was doing at Bitcoin.com. I'm experimenting with a foundation I'm calling the Permissionless Software Foundation. And it is largely an experiment, but if the experiment bears fruit, it should solve a lot of these funding problems, where this great problem of how do we fund open source infrastructure. It's sort of my attempt to solve that problem, and it uses SLP tokens, and so that makes it really fun to play with. And we're not taking it too seriously at this point. It's just an experiment, kind of just throwing mud at the wall, seeing if it sticks. But fullstack.cash is where people should go, especially if you're a developer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Troutner, also Telegram at Chris Troutner. But if you go to fullstack.cash, that's probably the easiest way to track me down on these other channels.
Boom. He is the man to kind of keep track of here. He is a thought leader and someone that just puts everything into perspective. I really appreciate your voice, man. I appreciate your sobriety, always willing to lend a hand. And it was great talking to you finally, officially, and we'll have you back on soon. But thanks so much again for coming on. We appreciate it.
You rock, Kelso. Thank you. You gotta keep it spicy.